Welcome to eHealth Talk, a podcast from Health Informatics New Zealand and hosted by me, news editor at HINZ, Rebecca McBeth. This podcast provides insight and discussion on key topics of interest from across New Zealand's data and digital health sector. Please be sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Kia ora koutou, welcome to eHealth Talk NZ. Today I'm joined by GPs Dr. Richard Medlicott and Dr. Carl Cole to talk about the use of generative AI in primary care in New Zealand. Welcome on the show to both of you. Can you start by telling our listeners a little about yourselves?
Oh, thank you, Rebecca. Yes. Two GPs. Is that a flock of GPs? Is it a crowd of GPs? Anyway, Richard and I know you really well. We've both worked in general practice for a long time now. I'm a GP in South Auckland, Papatoa. And I've spent about half my time doing various management and IT projects in the last 10 years. And before that, I had about a 15-year career in the military.
Thanks, Carl. Kia ora, everyone. So I'm Richard Medlicott. My main job is a GP in Island Bay, Wellington. Quite a different practice to Carl's, a slightly more affluent suburb. My main job as a GP, I've had various roles in the past, being medical director of the College of GPs. I was on the board of our PHO Toward a Compass for a long time, and I've had long interest in health IT. One declaration or interest for this particular podcast is recently I've started working with a company called IntelliTech 21, which is developing an AI for use in the New Zealand context. So that's me, and I've dropped a lot of that committee stuff over the years, so it's quite nice. I'm seeing a few more patients and just concentrating on this other side gig.
Great. Yeah, I think it's fair to say you're both leaders in primary care and especially in data and digital, so it's great to have you on. So today we are talking about the use of generative AI in primary care. Firstly, can you just take us through what is Gen AI, Carl?
So I should probably follow Richard's lead and declare that I am working now with Spark Health, which is just announced last week after working in Health Alliance. It's my first time working with a vendor side of world, where most of my other works has been contracting or working in PHOs and for the DHBs. And I am on the College GPs board as well as the ProCare board last December. Generative AI, geez, it really annoys me, these sort of phrases we have in IT. It sort of shows the sort of more unregulated sort of sales side of things, that little terms and that take off. To me, it's been around for a heck of a long time. I remember using it over the years, being a bit disappointed in chatbox. But the generative part of it really is reflecting that it's kind of generating content, a word that people see. Whereabouts the actual math, the probability statistics, the word association, I'm guessing the next bit, has all been around for a long time. It's part of our search engines, part of what Facebook do to track us. And the generative part is this producing things from that in smarter, smarter, more accessible ways. So it's sort of grown, but it's been very popular by ChatGPT, of course. And it can be quite astounding when you first see it. You think it's actually generated some thinking or content, when it's actually no more than very fast mathematical probable word association kind of things. But it's easy to think it's actually thinking and producing thoughts and generating, rather than just producing outputs from an algorithm and probability.
It's certainly true. The first time you have a go at it, you are a little bit amazed at what it can do. Did you have something to add, Richard?
Yeah, look, that's a good summary, I think, of what it does, especially about that generative stuff. And it leads to some of the weaknesses with Gen AI, because it's a probability based on what word is most likely to come next. That's a very basic summary. Sometimes you get some weird stuff happening, and they get called hallucinations. I think it's really confabulation, and we as doctors and health professionals, it's actually filling in the gap when it doesn't know stuff. So, for example, I had a friend who works in data and digital, asked one of the large language models, AI models, to do a literature review on something, and it did not a bad job. But no innovative thinking, nothing new, because it's only pulling out what's already there. So you're not going to get innovation out of it. And then at the end was a whole list of references, because, of course, when you do a literature review, at the end of it, there's a list of references. These references didn't exist. Just the the AI knew that at the end of a literature review, there's a list of links and names. So just put a list of links and names that went nowhere. So that's a real confabulation.
Yeah, certainly we'll come back to some of those kind of limitations and potential risks later. But first, Richard, maybe you could answer this one. What opportunities does Gen AI present to GPs like yourselves? Sort of what problems can it potentially solve?
You know, we're all overworked. We're all feeling the pressure. There's a shortage of healthcare professionals. So in the current context of what we do, we want to save time, and that's saving time during the consultation and also when we're not seeing patients, so thinking inbox management, for example. We're wanting decreased cognitive load so that when you are seeing your 15 patients in a session, at the end of it, you're not feeling shattered and shell-shocked like we often are. And then the third part, I guess, which we haven't seen so much here, but is actually reducing the load coming into the practice. So patients are getting information that they hopefully can trust to help them manage their conditions without actually touching us at all.
What I really experienced myself and made me sort of focus so much more, it's the first time I've had technology actually help me be more productive and feel less tired, as Richard pointed out, versus technology we've had to bend to and had to use our brain to use and become annoters and you know, structured data coders while we do our job. We've actually, this has changed that and flipped it, and it actually made my job easier to be back to be a real person-based doctor that looks at patients' eyes while we're talking to them rather than the screen.
So how is it being used by GPs in New Zealand?
Last I heard, around 400 have got licenses in New Zealand, speaking to the Nebula people. Are these other products being used too? I know people are using robots for inbox. Most of the products they're built on are very easy to access or open source. The actual tools are not hidden behind any kind of IP or anything. So I did do a podcast for Medical Protection Society, and they had people online doing queries, and it scared the heck out of me that a fair few admitted to using ChatGPT for medical notes, which I quickly said that I would never use that in a million years to do any kind of referrals or put patient information into. It's quite clear, both from a privacy and security point of view, you're liable and you need to be due diligence on that.
So my experience is, you know, 4 or 5 months of using Nabla is the main experience. Like a lot of GPs are using, probably saving me a couple of minutes per consultation. It's remembering things that I actually forgot was in the consultation when it comes to writing up the notes. It is by no means perfect. It misinterprets a few things, so you have to check your notes and put in your own voice. This is just one of many tools out there, and as I say, I'm developing another one which will be based on using Australasian servers. As we get servers available here in New Zealand, we'll use those. We'll have New Zealand governance, and it'll integrate with MedTech Evolution. So
just for those who don't know what it is, what are we talking about? What is Nabla? What is it actually doing?
Well, I started using it about 6 months ago, and inside a browser, it can record and transcribe in stunning accuracy. When you've used dictation in the past, you sort of see this, and on a standard iPhone or iPad, or a reasonably good microphone, which most of us have got post-COVID using web meetings, and in a quiet room, it gets about 90 to 95% correct and transcribes the whole conversation. Sometimes during the conversation, suggestions are offered to you to ask questions, but often it just finishes the transcription and then it produces, this is a generative bit, a note based on templates and settings you have. And the reason I've liked Nabla is because it's very, very protection around not having any integration yet, in terms of it doesn't pull anything from the EHR. It's a standalone inside either your phone or a browser tab, and then the editing tools standalone, and you have to copy and edit it back in. And it has ways of, as it's grown as a SaaS product, a software as a service, you can then do edits smarter now and do sort of make it more concise, and it just reruns it. The fact that it feels like someone's listening and just taking notes for you. And even if it's not a perfect note, you can either regenerate it or just use parts of it. And it's just much more easier, and it's more human. You're looking at the patient a lot more. The second part is the patient instructions it can generate. You can ask it to generate a separate set of instructions that was part of the goal of Open Notes that Richard and I are both very big advocates of. And the patients who are going through a merry-go-round of trying to diagnose their undifferentiated problems, it really helps to have what was next, what was planned, what we agreed for them. I'm using it practically for most consultations, but it's definitely better for some other than others. It's stopping me staying in the practice for another hour a day trying to catch up on my notes.
Yeah, I mean, in summary, basically what it is it's a silent scribe. It's listening in the background and giving you an SOAP note at the end, which you can copy and paste. The way forward is actually it integrates with your PMS and puts the data in there, puts in your blood pressure, puts in your diagnosis and so on. And this will all come. But you know, where do we want to head to? I guess really we're doing less and less interaction with the keyboard, more and more interaction with the patient, and it's picking up cues. It'll ask you if you say something like, "I'll send a note through to my nurse to do X, Y, and Z," or create a task to go through to the nurse to do X, Y, and Z. So that's kind of where we're headed. It's really baby steps now, but. We're just so under the pump at the moment, and we need something to change. You know, I'm not holding my breath for funding to change or 500 new GPs or 1,000 new nurse practitioners. They're just not in the pipeline, unfortunately, and we've got so many retirements. We've got increased patient expectations, so we need something, and this is our best shot, I reckon.
We've talked about, you know, using it in clinical practice, but does it change the way you interact with patients or conduct consultations if you're relying on actions and things that you're saying being picked up by a scribe? Presumably, you have to articulate everything if you want a scribe to pick it up.
I think that's probably why I don't always run on time. I really emphasise, and I think the only way we can survive is, you know, by empowering patients to be self-managing both for their clinical portals, that's the notes, and actually repeating back the management plan to them. So we're going to do these blood tests. It's essential you do that. In 3 months' time, we need to repeat this HbA1c. This is an information around it. And so it's picked it all up because I say it. And I think probably the doctor that might sit there and grunt and go, here's the pill, take it, and expects the scribe to understand, well, of course, they're not going to have a very good time with this. I've also learnt, though, I've had to sort of dictate the physical exam in a very clear way. And some of the newer changes I've made is I've got key phrases. So if you say something like SpongeBob, which I've got now, normal clinical exam, it picks it up every single time and it puts in normal clinical exam. But if you just say normal clinical exam, it might miss it or you mumble it. So that's been quite useful to change. That's the only really effective change I've made, is trying to say those physical exams out loud.
Yeah, I agree. I've just been a little bit more explicit about the physical exam. And look, these are things which we should be doing anyway. And I think I've always been a bit of a talker through the examination findings. So I'm just a bit more explicit about it.
Talking about patients, how do you approach this with patients? Do you ask their consent to use this in the background, or how does that process work?
So we started off with a very clear consent process and consented with a keyword in the PMS. And then we had probably about 1,000 people through and no one had batted an eyelid, and they were just generally very positive and interested. So we decided that the opening gambit of a consultation, when you're welcoming someone in, it was actually more of a barrier to take that explicit consent. So we've dropped it, and some people may disagree with that, but that's our reasoning. The sense we were getting was that we had some social license to do so. I do need to update our website and update the screen on our TV to say that this is a tool that we're using. You know, when someone signs their registration form, they're consenting to all kinds of sharing of information. But it's in an environment of a huge amount of digital sharing, and actually a transcript not linked to patient identifiable information, to my mind, carries less risk than what you've been doing for the last 20 years.
And we have touched on this already, Carl, but overall, what is the impact of using this tool in particular, or kind of Gen AI tools, having on your work personally, your wider practice? I don't know if it's used across practice, and for your patients.
So the impact has been, it almost feels like cheating. It does. It feels like I'm cheating. I finished Monday, I had 34 patients, plus I had 20 online scripts, plus 150 blood results came through, and I wasn't shattered. And it was just, it's such a different experience. It felt like I had an assistant and like I had a good medical student. Some days I'd be ahead of you and write some notes and you could just agree to them and make a slight change. And because I know patients so well, it's very conversational, straight to the point, hello, how's it going? Yes, your Parkinson's is looking a lot worse. And the really psychological intense stuff, you're just there for them, and it's you're not having to be distracted. And that, I think I just found it very draining. I'm not very good at writing, so I probably find it more draining than other people do. So that's been the impact. Is, you know, someone comes in, you have these really intense moments of people who are suicidal. They're bringing up the fact that their sexual abuse is now coming back to roost on them when they were 16, and now they've come across something because their nephews had some, and they're trying to support them. And you're in this intense 10 minutes to be able to have something sum up very well, agreed, and just move on without having to go back to at the end of the day. And we get this sort of cascading effect where then you're trying to remember, what happened to that one? Oh, and you're not there. It's amazing. So to me, it's been that cognitive offloading. You've got to experience it to believe it. and the time that gives you back to do the other stuff that we've had to compromise on in terms of thoroughness. I'm doing referrals inside the 10 minutes, like sometimes two of them for that, because it can just produce a good referral.
How about you, Richard? What's the overall impact been for you? Is your whole practice using it?
Probably about half of the doctors are using it. There's a certain element for a younger doctor, I think, sometimes has to find their voice. I'm not sure whether I'd recommend it on day one, but of course, often they need the most help. It's something you just got to think about and think through. And I think maybe GP trainers, registrar trainers need to think about how this fits into the training moving forward. But yeah, lifting of cognitive load, that's the main thing. I mean, there's a bit of time saving, which is important, clearly. You know, 2 minutes per patient, I think that's probably my time saving, which adds up. It's 80% done. And I'll review the note and tweak a few things, take out some of the verbiage, still have to do the coding, still have to insert the blood pressure and so on into screening, but that'll change in the future. So, yeah, I think it's the cognitive load for me is the big thing.
So Health New Zealand Te Whatua have told their staff not to use AI for clinical purposes at this stage because of the risks involved. So just wondering, how have you assessed the potential risks, and are you in discussions with Health New Zealand about your use of these tools?
I think there are some issues. So, for example, the terms and conditions of NABLA give them some leeway to use the data for, say, training the large language model, which they say they don't do. I would prefer that the servers were in New Zealand or Australia. But from what we're told, the information goes up, is transformed, and comes back and is deleted. In terms of specific discussions with Te Whatuora, no, I haven't, although I did meet Lee Donoghue, the head of data and digital for Te Whatuora, a wee while ago, and showed him this. And he was very excited. You know, I think that there's tension between recognizing that these tools are coming and just being a bit cautious. I wouldn't be surprised if there are people in Te Whatuora who are using it. Our contract is with the PHO, not with the DA or Te Whatuora, so we're slightly removed from that directive. I'm not an employee of Te Whatuora. But hopefully some of those concerns around, say, where the servers are and local governance and so on can be changed. And I know that the company I'm working with will be looking to solve some of those remaining concerns.
What about you, Carl? Are you sort of in discussions? There must be a lot of interest in what you're doing, I imagine.
It's hard to sum up 6 months and thing, but Richard's right. I've come from a different angle because I was a Te Whatuora employee up to the 5th of January. I had, you know, from Health Alliance, the Chief Information Clinical Information Officer of that shared agency in the Northern Region, of course, is one of the shared agencies that merged into all the DHBs in the, I think, 15 or so around the country. When I presented to them, they were happy that we were being responsible, we were checking, we were asking people to do due diligence. And one of the crucial things is having the human in the loop. I am not convinced at all about any automative writing back. When you start seeing the mistakes come through and all the thing else, any generative AI that's automatically making classifications or doing suggestions without you seeing where it came from, that's why I like this. You've just done the conversation in 10 minutes. It sums it up. It's in your short-term memory and you're responsible for it going back, is pretty safe, right? It doesn't record what you think about it unless you say, so there's no way they can be learning from it. So there's no suggestion that they're getting IP from you unless you're submitting back what you thought, because they can't go, this was a good answer or not a good answer without you saying that. So a lot of the concerns, which are very good concerns about the whole of the AI, are controlled. And it's making sure you are happy in yourself, because in the end, as an independent providers, you are actually responsible that you've done it to a level that's consistent and good enough, basically. NABLA come from a culture of trying to help with this area, and you're in the background. And having worked in the commercial side, it's a shocking what has happened in the past. Not saying that excuses having contracts which are loose, but most of the IT never covered this sort of stuff, the use of, in all sorts of ways. And these contracts quite normally have sort of get out of jail cards to protect the vendors, because they don't want to be responsible. So everyone's trying to toss the responsibility back and forth. What's really helped me is that places like Kaiser Permanente and other things which are very, very responsible medical health systems have gone through and come up with the conclusion, particularly the way it's designed and had independent audits, it is safe. Richard and I agree on most things, but one thing I don't agree on is it having to be in New Zealand. I think there's unsafe practice in New Zealand with cowboy servers that are a lot riskier than having it in Azure under the right security protections, which you have to pay for and get done and have penetration testing. So that's the advantage of being unregulated. You can make your own judgment call, right? No one's doing it for you, but it does mean you have to make that decision and be able to stand by it.
And, you know, we touched on at the start about, you know, the ability to hallucinate. And there's also quite a lot of discussion about sort of biases within these large language models. And I know it's in a different context, but, you know, we've had people talking about, you know, recommending more treatment for patients who already get more treatment. A white Pākehā male might be offered something different from someone else by AI, because that's traditionally what's happened in the health system, for example. But so you're saying within this, it's very controlled. It's not trying to come up with answers or trying to prompt you with ideas around the next clinical decision. It's only doing the note.
Yeah, and that's what's been experimented with, and that's what I'm very cautious of. Yeah, that's kind of the area. This is a transcription, which is of the conversation rather than a monologue, like the old dictation of Dragon Dictate, that then is summarised. There's potential for bias of it not picking the words out, and you forgot that's there, but it more often finds things that you would have forgotten. It's not, and there's the AI proposed around, it's just this type of product isn't to be confused with the suggestion that you should do this blood count on this person or in that, which would replicate biases, which is everywhere anyway. So there is potential for bias in terms of what it picks out of the conversation to summarise, I guess. But as Richard said, I think the most significant bias is missing the fact it's done these hallucinations, which I don't like the word, I call them calculation mishaps, because that's what they are. They're sort of like probability statistics which have gone wrong. If I went to breakfast and I ordered orange, the most likely word would be juice from people's experience and their background. But it could be I ordered orange paint. And if I said that in the conversation, it gets overruled and says I ordered orange juice, but in the conversation I said I ordered orange paint. That's the kind of error that happens. And you call that a bias, that's more of a hallucination. And I do believe the bias in suggestions or summing up data is possible and unproven. We don't know where that goes wrong yet, so that's why I've stayed away from that for the moment until we get better evaluation techniques to work out, you know, if we chuck someone's entire health record in, will it produce the ultimate problem list that doctors aren't doing? Maybe it will, but it's bound to be making biases, so I'm staying well away from that kind of thing.
What about you, Richard? Obviously, you see a kind of future where it is connected into the electronic health record. You know, what do you see as the future of these technologies in primary care and our ability to take advantage of these while also being safe and acknowledging risks?
Yeah, so look, I see the future. I touched on it before of having a silent assistant in the office who's handling a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of us of sorting the tasks that come out of every consultation, and as a side issue, also looking at our inbox management. Yeah, really interesting questions about biases, because at the moment, we're not sending up any information around age or ethnicity or gender. And so you're getting quite a generic summary back, but it is just a summary of our conversation. But the company I'm working with is looking at, this is a feature you can switch off, and I think most GPs here would switch it off, but we're also in the American market, where it's suggesting questions you might want to ask in real time, which is really interesting as it comes up, and suggesting therapies. Now, we're at a relatively early stage in our company, but it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops. But maybe some of these biases are useful. So if the system does know that you have a 52-year-old Maori gentleman who has not had a cardiovascular screening done, then it might prompt you to do that and ideally send some information to the patient about getting checked and then doing the calculation or sending the lab form to the lab. So there's pros and cons around how much other data you link to it. I mean, I guess what we're after will be a system that can be as nuanced as we are in terms of recognizing that people are different and people do need different needs depending on their backgrounds and where they're coming from. At the moment, it's still our job to recognize that, but we'll just have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, well said, Richard. Working on the GP college, I think one of the frustrating things is that these some people do not believe they're biased. So he's a real example to say that we're all biased. It's just establishing how much and how we can get feedback on it. And the traditional way we've done that is through prompts and you know, financial incentives to try and correct population level biases. But it doesn't really work when you get down to individual. We all quote individual, you know, things where it's stupid to have this prompt and we get annoyed by them. But if they become very nuanced and it can be based on your practice, based on your last 1,000 practices, you know, of patients, it could become very, and we wouldn't turn off those suggestions to go, oh, geez, that's a good point. Just like when you've spoken with the corridor, oh, I've got this patient, the hemoglobin's not quite going down, but no, I'm warfarin, it could be that. And I said, have you done this? You go, no, they haven't had that. And you run away and you go back, we'll experience that. So if it gets that nuanced, that would be welcome arms, right? At the moment, our attempts in the past have been just way too sort of shotgun, and we get so frustrated with the alerts, and they're often irrelevant.
Well, certainly lots of interesting times ahead for us to look forward to. We're going to have to wrap it up. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been such a fascinating discussion. And yeah, we'll see how things continue to develop. Ka kite.
Thanks for listening to eHealth Talk. Be sure to subscribe and share with your colleagues and friends. eHealth Talk, eHealth News and the eHealth webinar series are supported by Health Informatics New Zealand. See hins.org.nz for more information and become a member starting at just $17 a month. We also have affordable organisational membership options for both our industry partners and healthcare providers.